Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
You're listening to Campus Killings, brought to you by Abject Entertainment. Be sure to check out some of the other great true crime podcasts from this network, including The Murder in My Family,
DNA ID, Zodiac Speaking,
Scene of the Crime, Missing Persons,
Beyond Bizarre True Crime,
and Citizen Detective. All of these podcasts are available for you to binge on right now, wherever you listen to podcasts. Subscribe where you're listening to this podcast so you don't miss an episode.
Two students die at a New Jersey college. A female graduate student is found murdered in the music building in 1977, and 29 years later, a male freshman goes missing, only for his body to be discovered in a landfill a whole state away. Both are still waiting for justice. Hi, Megan. Today's episode takes us to what is today called the College of New Jersey, or TCNJ, as the students call it. But we're going back in time for half of this episode to 1977, when the college was known as Trenton State College, or TSC. So, while we talk about the first case, I'll be referring to the college as TSC. And then when we move on to the second case, I'll be referring to the school as TCNJ. Before we get started, I'd like to give a huge shout out and special thanks to Scott Knapp of Save Sigrid for giving us so much wonderful backstory on Sigrid Stevenson, and we'll talk about him a little more at the end. All right, well, as we normally do, I'll give you a little background on the university before getting into the actual case, just so we can get a sense of where we're at. TCNJ, or as it was known in 1977, Trenton State, has changed its name quite a few times since its inception in 1855, when it began as what was called Normal School. Now, I had no idea what a normal school was, and I had to look it up. So essentially, Megan, it was a 19th century institution that was specifically aimed at teaching the norms of pedagogy to people who were looking to be primary school teachers. And the work conducted for the degree was around a high school level. So this New Jersey State Normal School was originally located in the downtown city of Trenton, and it stayed in that location from 1855 all the way up until 1928, when it added a four-year degree for teaching and needed a bigger space. That's when the campus was relocated to Ewing, New Jersey, which is just outside of Trenton. And with the move came a new name, New Jersey State Teachers College. The college added a graduate program, accreditation, and a bunch of new programs in the late 50s, garnering a third name change, Trenton State College. And then it didn't become the College of New Jersey, or TCNJ, until 1996.
Oh my gosh, that's too many changes.
That's quite a history,
right? Too many name changes, I think.
Yes. Well, today, TCNJ is a competitive liberal arts school with a little over 7,000 students annually. And while it does grant degrees in a number of areas, the school is still best known for its education program. Okay, so our first case takes place on Labor Day weekend of 1977 at the Ewing campus. In 77, the campus was known for its beautiful grounds and brick buildings. One of its best-known buildings was Kendall Hall, which was a performance center that had been built in 1932. Now, this performance center contained a large performance theater, a black box theater, musical practice rooms, faculty and staff offices, and a few classrooms. So let's just say it was a pretty big building with a lot going on.
Okay.
And in it, on the stage, was a grand piano that students could practice on. By all accounts, this space was open for students at any given time if there weren't performances going on. And one student in particular was very interested in this piano. That student was Sigrid Stevenson, a 25-year-old woman from Livermore, California. Sigrid was born to parents Barbara and Peter Stevenson, who were originally from New Jersey. Peter was a renowned nuclear physicist, while Barbara was a homemaker who enjoyed raising her two children. Sigrid had a sister named Sylvia. Peter played the guitar and several other instruments for his children, and Sigrid took an instant liking to music, even as a very young child. And it became clear very quickly that Sigrid had a proclivity for music, so she began piano lessons and they really took off. Throughout her school year, she became known for her musical skill, and she often played in concerts and productions, even as a teenager. She would go on to earn her bachelor's degree in music from the University of California, but she wasn't really a fan of the West Coast life, and she decided to look to the East Coast for her master's, which is how she found Trenton State College. By all accounts, Sigrid was a planner, and she paid for her master's tuition by giving piano and guitar lessons. She also continued playing for a host of productions, and she even provided tutoring in English. And she had a plan for her East Coast future as well. She had lined up a student teaching job at a local Ewing Elementary School for her last semester of study. Now, a lot of her friends would describe her as a handful, particularly her mother, because she had a particular sense of self and she didn't really care about conforming to social standards. She also tended to be overly friendly and chatty, but some would say that she often missed social cues, which made some of her peers uncomfortable. Megan, I'm thinking today we'd probably speculate that she was maybe on the autism spectrum based on, you know, the recounting of her personality. But in the 70s, she was likely just viewed as willful and maybe a bit odd.
Okay.
However, as much as she didn't have many close friends, she was a very friendly person and she had no problems being alone or doing things independently. And this independence served her well, as she wasn't afraid to advocate for herself and she wasn't afraid to make plans for her own future. The summer before her return to Trenton State College, Sigrid secured semester housing at the home of a fireman and his family who lived right across the street from the school. Now, it's not clear if she was renting the home from them or just renting a room, but either way, she would be very close to the performance building, Kendall Hall. Sigrid also took that summer to travel, and she hitched all the way up the East Coast to Canada all by herself. Now,
wow.
To our listeners, hitchhiking may seem like a dangerous or a bad decision, and I would tend to agree. However, in the 70s, hitchhiking was incredibly common as a way for young people to travel on a budget.
I mean, my mom used to hitchhike, according to her stories, and she and my dad picked up a couple hitchhikers, and I was so surprised, but she said it was kind of normal then.
Yeah, so we might view this choice as a bit strange today, but as you point out, it wasn't for that time period. Also, Megan, as someone who studies serial killers, I'm sure you can tell us that hitchhiking is how so many serial killers come across their victims, especially in this time period.
Absolutely.
Actually, what does strike me about this is 1977, remember what that was? That was someone very famous. It was the summer of?
Summer of Sam.
Yeah, so the son of Sam was the serial killer from Queens who preyed on women in cars. And Sigrid was hitching her way through New York at that same time. But she did make it back safely, which makes what's coming next so difficult to fathom.
Oh. Also, Son of Sam didn't pick up hitchhikers. He did prey on people in vehicles, but usually parked vehicles.
And... yeah, that's true. That was the one that he would go to, like, lover lanes, right? They call them.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So when Sigrid returned from her trip, it was Labor Day weekend. And on September 3rd, 5 days before the start of the new semester, she went to Kendall Hall to see a play that was being put on by a local theater company. By all accounts, she went there by herself, although she did know several members of the cast and crew, and she had just come out to support their production. After it was over, she had decided to stay in the building to work on her own music. But around midnight, a campus security officer noticed Sigrid's bike parked outside of Kendall Hall. He thought this was a little strange that she would be practicing so late at night, so he went into the performance center to check on her. He did find the doors to the building locked, although it was later reported that one of the doors was faulty and could be opened with a hard push, regardless of the locking mechanism. When he let himself in, because again, he's a security guard, so he likely had a key. When he let himself in, he could not believe what he had found. On the stage, the body of a young woman lay face down and naked, covered in a large white sheet that had been the piano's dust cover. There was blood everywhere. It had been splattered all over the music sheets that were still on the piano, and there was a heavy blood trail from the piano to where her body was. When the Ewing police were called to investigate the scene, they found that the woman's face was so badly damaged that she could not be immediately identified, and her hands had also been bound. Now, campus security knew that it was Sigrid's bike outside of Kendall Hall, and finding no one else in the building, it made sense that they believed right away that the victim lying on the stage was, in fact, Sigrid.
Was she beaten to death, or were there other, was she stabbed?
Yeah.
I'm assuming you're going to get into that.
Yeah, so she had been violently beaten around the head with a blunt object, although there were no weapons or blunt objects found at the scene. There's also no mention in any of the sources of a sexual assault. And cops found her purse at the scene with money inside, so we can also rule out robbery.
You said she was naked, though, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
The medical examiner's report ruled that the cause of death was a skull fracture. She had also bled profusely from cuts on her face and lip, which also make me wonder about the murder weapon. It seems personal, especially given that she was targeted, you know, around her face. I'm also wondering, was it opportunistic? Somebody who was looking for trouble found her by herself late at night? You know, it's hard to really know what's going on here.
It's hard, but in the absence of a robbery or a sexual assault, it does seem possible to indicate, you know, something personal and
yeah,
such a vicious
I would agree.
Beating.
Unfortunately, aside from the blood-splattered music pages and a pile of Sigrid's discarded belongings, there were no fingerprints, no shoe prints, no weapon, and no clue of any kind of who could have done this to this young girl. The investigators literally had nothing but Sigrid's body to go on.
And now, a brief word from our sponsors.
Police questioned over 100 people on the TSC campus the day following Sigrid's murder, asking everyone and anyone if they knew what had happened or if they had seen anything. But unfortunately, none of these interviews led investigators to anything plausible. Sigrid didn't seem to have any private relationships at the time of her murder. She wasn't involved with anyone in particular, and she was by all accounts a kind and gregarious person. Nobody could fathom who would want to kill her. And this was particularly frustrating since the brutality of the murder seemed incredibly personal. It almost seems as if someone was trying to erase her identity with the amount of damage that they caused to her face.
Ugh.
There was some speculation that the perpetrator had to have been familiar with the college and specifically Kendall Hall. Now, based on Kendall Hall's location, it's not really plausible that someone walking onto campus off the street would stumble upon it. Based on the little evidence left at the scene, it was clear that whoever had done it knew their way around the twisted corridors and side entrances of the enormous building, and quite likely knew that Sigrid would be practicing there.
Which also lends credibility to the theory that it was someone she knew.
Yep. Or at least someone that was watching her for some time.
Yeah, or someone, and yep. Also someone on campus.
Yep.
In one way, you know, in one way or the other.
And while police worked diligently for months hunting down leads, they all ended up as dead ends and they had nothing to go on. The case quickly went cold, and while the Ewing Police Department still has this on the books as an open case that does get revisited every couple of years, there have been no breaks in this case in 46 years.
Amy, what was the school's response to this crime?
Yeah, that's a good question, because from what I could find, there had never been a murder on TSC's campus before, so this was an unprecedented event for the school. And it happened literally right at the beginning of the fall semester. So you have all these students coming back to campus after their summer break and a whole new class of freshmen who wouldn't even know where things were located, right?
So were they going to shut down the school? I mean, this is really a bad crime, though. This is really vicious. It's terrifying.
Yeah. And I could imagine parents and students would find this to be a shocking turn of events and quite possibly maybe wouldn't want their students to go to campus. You know, but times are different now than they were in 1977. So the way a university responds today is not the same as they would in the past. But I'm interested to see what you think about the administration's actions after this murder. And then we'll talk a little bit about some of the reactions we've seen current day.
Okay.
So TSC's administrative response was to pass out a one-page flyer to the over 1,000 incoming freshmen titled, quote, 10 Steps to Secure Living. Now, this document contains suggestions like lock your door when sleeping or lock your door even if you'll only be gone a few minutes. Administration encouraged professors also to remind students that if they were going out at night, not to go alone and to stay in groups when walking around campus after hours.
Wait, so they didn't make it known that there was a murder? Okay.
However, no. For all of their talk of caution, the college administration made no plans to change or enhance security measures on the campus, and they kept the campus security at 12 armed police officers and 7 security guards. In addition, the dean of students at the time, Dr. Paddock, told the media, "This is just a normal reaction to the situation, one of concern. There does not appear to be fear or anything of that nature. We are encouraging students to use normal precautions."
Yeah, I don't think this is an appropriate response in any way.
No, and also, you know, the media, the surrounding media did post headlines like, quote, Trenton State students enter campus of fear. But most of the students didn't seem at all bothered that there had been a murder in the performance building that they would soon be attending class in. And students were observed moving calmly and seemingly unbothered around campus just days later. In fact, one former student wrote an opinion piece on the murder saying, quote, there was no discussion on campus that fall. It was downplayed and nobody seemed afraid.
That's very surprising to me.
And I think it's interesting because the case was not even covered that heavily by the media. It did make some headlines in local papers, like the local Trentonian. There was a short piece that I found in the New York Times, but that's really all. And most of the articles for the case have been written within the last 10 years, and they're more retrospective rather than reporting on the case.
Say the school probably had some pretty good PR people.
I was thinking that.
It's also prior to the advent of, you know, social media.
Yes, that I think that does make a huge difference. Because like we saw in the Idaho homicide case, students were, you know, everyone got something on their phone that told them, you know, shelter in place. We see that even at our school. Anytime there's an incident in the surrounding areas, there's a shelter in place because you can reach people so much quicker, of course, with cell phones.
Exactly. Seems like the school didn't acknowledge the crime. Did they acknowledge her? Did they do anything to honor her memory or commemorate her in any way?
I mean, not really. Aside from TCNJ's campus police still working directly with Ewing's detectives on the case, and by this I mean they periodically meet with Mercer County Prosecutor's Office to see if there's any new evidence, the college has done virtually nothing in regards to keeping Sigrid's memory alive. To this day, Megan, there's no plaque on or near Kendall Hall in her honor. There are no scholarship accounts in her name, nor is there any recognition of her at all, aside from a few original news stories on microfiche located in the college library.
That's very sad. Seems like they just erased her.
Yeah. And Sigrid Stevenson's only lasting legacies are, unfortunately, the ghost stories that students circulate surrounding her murder. Because across many years, TCNJ students have talked about experiencing paranormal activity in Kendall Hall. You know, things like doors closing by themselves or echoing sounds of a piano playing when nobody is there. The school actually called in a psychic and a medium to see if any information could be garnered. It's unclear if this was done for entertainment as a student program or for investigative purposes, but students have also reportedly hosted seances in the performance space trying to communicate with, quote, the ghost of Kendall Hall.
I sincerely hope the school did not do that for entertainment. Let me just say that. I'd be very disgusted to hear that.
I think we all would be. And while I suppose in some ways the ghost stories keep Sigrid in people's minds, I do feel like the school could have done something official to remember her.
Absolutely.
I mean, we can theorize that maybe because of what they consider the personal nature of Sigrid's murder, that the school felt that this was probably an isolated incident that could be swept under the rug. But Megan, 29 years later, another TCNJ student would be found dead under mysterious circumstances. And this time, the family wanted answers.
We'll return after a brief word from our sponsors.
In 2006, John Fiocco Jr. was a 19-year-old college freshman just starting his second semester as an art major at TCNJ. John had grown up in Mantua, New Jersey with his parents, Susan and John Sr. He also had three siblings. They were a close family, and their home was known for being a warm place full of light and laughter. Johnny, as his family called him, was described as a very well-liked guy who was charismatic, smart, and just fun to be around. And the photos I've seen of him online show a young man who indeed looked very happy and carefree. Johnny was physically active, and he'd been a football player and a team captain for his track team in high school. And while it didn't look like he had gotten into sports at TCNJ, he was known to enjoy going to sporting events, and he particularly liked to watch wrestling on TV. I know we tend to say this a lot about most of the people we discuss on this show, but Johnny really did seem to have everything going for him.
Well, we cover a lot of young people on the show, too, in like the prime of their education and kind of the beginning of their
promise.
Life.
Yeah, so much promise, so much potential.
Yeah.
And like most college students, Johnny went to parties and he hung out with his friends a lot. So it's not surprising that on a Friday night in late March, Johnny and his friends were pre-gaming in their dorm building. You remember doing this, I'm sure.
Of course.
Yes. So they were in Wolf Hall before heading out to an off-campus party. The group stayed off campus till around midnight when they came back to Wolf Hall and continued to have a post-party in Johnny's dorm room on the fourth floor. And Johnny's friends all reported that while it was clear that he had been drinking, he wasn't stumbling or inebriated. He clearly had control of all his faculties, and he seemed more like he was just feeling really good. At some point between 2 and 3 a.m., Johnny decided to leave the post-party to go a few doors down to a different group of friends to stay with them for a little. It's not clear exactly what happened after he went down the hall, but around 10 a.m. on Saturday, about 6 hours later, Johnny was nowhere to be found. Now, his friends thought this was odd because Johnny's shoes were still in his friend's dorm where he had kicked them off the night before. And Johnny's roommate reported that it didn't appear that Johnny had come back to get any new shoes or had moved any of his belongings. So that was pretty strange, but no one was really panicking at this time because it was possible Johnny had just gone to get some breakfast at the cafeteria, or maybe he was somewhere off campus.
I'm sorry, Amy, can you remind me what year this was?
2006.
Okay. I was trying to get an idea of surveillance and cell phones.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep, and we will talk about that also. However, by 3 p.m. on Saturday, no one had heard from Johnny still, and his roommate was now starting to get a little worried, and he went to file a missing persons report with campus police. However, and we see this over and over again, the campus police told the roommate that college students go silent over the weekend all the time. He may be sleeping off a hangover, or maybe he's hanging out with a friend or a significant other. They didn't seem to take Johnny's disappearance very serious, and they were confident that he would show back up on Monday to attend classes. Well, do you think Johnny showed back up on Monday?
No, I'm going to say he didn't show up, unfortunately.
He didn't. And now a lot of valuable, crucial time has been lost, because by this point, no one had seen Johnny for 36 hours.
Oh, that's a long time. And we know the first hours are the most crucial when someone goes missing.
And at this point, since he's been gone for so long, the campus police called in state troopers to take over the investigation. And the investigators immediately began questioning all of the students Johnny had last had contact with, as well as starting a search of his dorm room and the dorm building. And about a day into the investigation, nothing was really coming to fruition until police went to Wolf Hall's basement where the trash chute emptied into a dumpster. Here they found blood all over the dumpster and the trash compactor. And inside the mostly empty dumpster, investigators found Johnny's wallet and his necklace. But Megan, no sign of Johnny.
Yeah, but I mean, obviously with the blood, him missing and his items being found, it's not good.
Yeah, this definitely doesn't look good. And of course, they took the blood samples and they immediately sent them out to the lab to see if they were a match to Johnny. But there was no body. And authorities were told that only hours before they had gone to the basement, the dumpsters had been emptied by the trash company.
Oh, that's terrible, too. What a bad struggle. Well, they would have. This is why acting sooner, everything is, the odds are better of finding evidence as well.
So, Megan, I think we're looking at really two options at this point. Either Johnny's body was halfway to a landfill or a fatally wounded student was somewhere in the building. So investigators evacuated all of Wolf Hall, as well as the adjacent dorm, so that they could search every crevice for clues. But after interviewing all of the students from the area and searching every single room, nothing came out of the investigation. No clues, and most importantly, no Johnny. Of course, by this point, Johnny's family had been made aware of his disappearance, and they had started a search of their own. His parents also held a vigil at their church, where over 100 friends and neighbors prayed with the family for Johnny's safe return. Although I think his parents may have known that there wouldn't be a happy ending to the story, as Johnny's father told all of the supporters that people, quote, should forgive anyone who was involved in his son's disappearance.
Wow.
And this is shocking to me, Megan, but about a month would pass before more answers came.
That's a long time. Okay. And
it's very surprising because in my sources, I found that it was a month and that it took a month for police to get the blood samples to return.
I need to know now.
Okay. You probably could guess what the blood samples told them.
Yeah, I'm sure they matched him. Yeah. But what I'm more concerned about is if they found him.
Well, once they confirmed that the blood was a match for Johnny, the investigation turned towards the dumpsters, tracing the garbage route to find out where those dumpsters had gone. And Megan, this took them to two landfill locations in Bucks County, Pennsylvania.
Oh, gosh, right near where I live.
I was just going to say, somehow Pennsylvania just keeps finding its way in all of our stories.
I know it does. In our other podcast.
Yes.
It's freaking me out a little bit, but okay.
Now, needless to say, searches like this take time, as first investigators, they had to figure out where in the landfill the TCNJ trash had been dumped. And then they had to perform an extensive search of the area. And I don't know if you know this, because I sure didn't, but when trash goes to landfills, it's dumped and then 6 inches of soil are scattered over the top. And it's layered like that. So forensic specialists were looking at sifting through over 23 feet of debris to find Johnny's body.
Well, they should have done this from the start when they found his items and blood. Waiting that long is obviously going to make it so much worse.
I'm not sure why they waited that long.
There's also body decomposition, too, that's going to be a problem.
And that's exactly right, Megan, because after several days of searching, forensic specialists found Johnny's badly decomposed body. But luckily, the medical examiner was still able to tell that all of his wounds were consistent with being crushed in a trash compactor. Now, there were no knife wounds, bullet holes, or any other marks on him that would have indicated a murder. So at this point, his death was ruled as, quote, suspicious, but authorities did not expect foul play. However, the ME did not disclose if Johnny had been alive or not at the time he was put in the trash compactor. Now, this, of course, is very important.
Are they saying he put himself in, possibly? Yeah.
Well, I think it's important to think about what the meaning of this is. If they could determine that Johnny was alive when he went into the trash compactor, maybe that would indicate an accident more so than if he was already deceased and someone was just disposing of the body.
Yeah, of course.
So, I mean, the big question here is how would Johnny have gotten stuck in a trash compactor? And I think it's safe to say, Megan, that rumors fly pretty rampant on college campuses and they have a way of spreading fast and far. And that was certainly the case for Johnny's disappearance and, of course, once his body was found. Now, students had tons of theories and speculations onto how this could have happened. And I bring this up because one rumor in particular sparked investigation. Now, some students had claimed that the drunk boys had been playing a game of hide and seek, and perhaps Johnny had drunkenly decided to hide in the garbage chute. Since the garbage chute emptied directly into the trash compactor, it made a little sense that his blood could have been found there, and investigators brought in a special camera that they actually snaked down the chute looking for blood, tissue, or any signs of dents or damage that could have been indicative of a broad-shouldered young man having been inside of it. But not surprisingly, nothing came back. There was nothing in the chute. Megan, we talked about this in Phoebe's case on Women in Crime. You know, we're talking about, in this case, the chute was a 2x2 opening with a single-loaded metal door that only opened down before snapping back into place. It was also, just like in Phoebe's case, several feet off the ground. It was located in a small closet at the end of the hall. So even if Johnny was very drunk, it would have been virtually impossible for him to push the chute's door down long enough to hoist himself up through the small opening and fall the four stories into the compactor.
I'm just going to say, I don't think that would be a very good hiding place either. So I no. didn't give much credence to that theory there.
No. So I think we could all agree that's not really a viable lead, right?
No.
Investigators then turned to other ways Johnny could have potentially gotten into the compactor. Perhaps he stumbled down to the basement and inadvertently gotten stuck. But again, this doesn't really seem plausible because the elevators in the building didn't go down to the basement, and the stairwell that led there had been two locked fire doors that were not accessible to students. Not to mention, the adjacent maintenance garage attached to the building with basement access was also always locked and was only accessible by employees. So, this begs the question, was this foul play after all?
I'm going to say yes. Does this have a conclusion? Please say yes.
And now, a brief word from our sponsors.
It was the night of the awful discovery. The apartment was dark. The faint, coppery scent of blood hung in the air.
I remember telling the boys, don't touch anything. We don't know what's happened here.
I'm Keith Morrison, and this is Murder in Apartment 12, our new podcast from Dateline. It's a story about a local beauty queen who'd been keeping secrets. It's about gossip, public opinion, and a tortured search for a killer.
I think they've got the wrong guy.
To listen to the latest episodes each week completely free, just search Murder in Apartment 12 wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, before we get to a potential suspect, I want to mention that a year later in 2007, when no movement on the case had been made, Johnny's parents filed a wrongful death lawsuit against TCNJ. Interestingly, during the suit, it came to light that none of those fire doors that were supposed to keep students away from the trash compactor were actually locked on the night that Johnny disappeared. So it is possible he could have gone down there. And as we have seen in so many other cases, the normally key card access only doors of Wolf Hall had been propped open for several hours that night, meaning that anyone could have come in and out of the building. So this leads us to the speculation that did something else happen to Johnny? Was someone in the building that shouldn't have been there, or somebody who knew Johnny? Maybe they had an issue with him, right?
I was going to say, is it possible this was a fight too that went wrong? And someone tried to cover up the crime.
Yeah, well, you know, as the suit was unfolding, a new piece of evidence would come to light that would, to me, seem like the first time we're hearing a theory that seems plausible. You let me know what you think.
Okay.
So the police had one person of interest that they interviewed pretty heavily in the initial days of the investigation, but they didn't seem to have enough evidence to continue to pursue this individual. Now, this person of interest name has never been publicly revealed, and there is no mention of him at all in any of the reports until a 2011 news article reporting on the suit. Known only as John Doe, this man was a graduate of TCNJ, and although he no longer lived on campus or attended the school, he lived in close proximity. And allegedly, he had told a few of his friends that he had killed Johnny Fiocco days into the freshman's disappearance.
All right, yeah. We're going to hear about the motive?
I don't know that we could say motive, but I think this will make things a little more clear for you. Okay. So his friends, of course, alerted authorities, as they should. And as a result, John Doe was extensively questioned. Investigators even went to talk to his mother and other relatives to kind of work up a study on him. And this is what they found. John Doe reportedly suffered from a manic depressive and bipolar disorder, and he had actually been in a psychiatric facility for his issues. He had recently stopped taking his medications, and his family described him as manic and bizarre when he was not on his medications. Furthermore, his mother told investigators that her son would often disappear at all hours of the night to walk around TCNJ's campus, and when she heard about Johnny's disappearance, she remembered asking herself where her own son was that night. And John Doe had indeed been on TCNJ's campus the night that Johnny went missing. John Doe also was involuntarily committed to another psychiatric facility 2 days after Johnny's disappearance. And lastly, nobody could corroborate an alibi for John Doe for the hour surrounding Johnny's disappearance. So this all sounds like a good suspect to me, but it doesn't seem like police have enough evidence to actually arrest this person. From what we're talking about here, we have seen cases where people are arrested on less evidence, but I would not be comfortable with them arresting someone on these few pieces of evidence. Would you agree?
I would agree. I don't know enough either to decipher if this is truly a very strong lead or if this is a case of rounding up the usual suspects.
Yep.
You know, he has always got these issues. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not sure. Based on what you told me, I wouldn't be able to say either way.
I totally agree. If they had surveillance of, you know, this person near the dorm, if they could check for fingerprints or any connection between these two guys, maybe, but I haven't heard of any of that.
Yeah, if there had been reported injuries, anything in it, of Johnny's in his possession, blood, yeah, a lot of things that I would like to see more of.
You know, so sadly, while Johnny's family won their wrongful death suit against TCNJ in 2012, his death still remains on the books as suspicious. And if it indeed was a homicide, no one has been brought to justice yet.
Oh, but they did win the suit.
They did. Yes.
So then maybe there was more evidence than we, you know, that's been published that we're just not aware of.
I don't know.
The standard in a civil suit is also less than in a criminal case.
I was also going to say they could be, you know, it's likely, remember I said during the civil suit, it came out that the doors weren't locked that should have been locked and that
a door was propped open.
So I don't know that there was additional information. It could have just been on the grounds that there was negligence on the part of the college.
I'm sorry. So the suit was against the college, not against the suspect.
Correct. Yes.
Yes. I thought you meant they won a wrongful death suit against this person. So I was going to say, wow, we've missed it. Oh, no.
Against TCNJ. That makes sense now. Okay.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense.
So this isn't technically considered a cold case since it was never officially ruled a homicide. But again, as of 2012, the case was still considered to be open. And while Johnny's family has said that they've come to a place of forgiveness of whoever did this to their son, they are still without closure. And almost 20 years later, they are still struggling with the loss of their loved one.
Of course.
Okay, so aside from paying a settlement to Johnny's family in the wrongful death suit, did TCNJ do anything else to acknowledge or remember Johnny? Because remember, they did not do much for Sigrid.
And I'm going to say they had to in this case.
Well, aside from a mention in the president's welcome back address in the fall of 2006, it doesn't seem that the school has done anything to remember Johnny. Much like in the case of Sigrid Stevenson, their stories have not been kept alive. And although Johnny's story is much more well known and it was discussed heavily on campus for months afterwards, that is likely due to the fact that times have changed and people are more social because of social media and word probably traveled quicker in Johnny's case than in Sigrid's case.
Sure.
I mean, we can say that TCNJ drastically changed their security measures after Johnny's death, though. One student who had been studying abroad when the incident happened recalled that coming back to campus, he was surprised at the addition of guards at gates and security checks to get on and off campus. Dormitory security was also changed, as well as the locking mechanisms on the doors to the trash compactor rooms. And that was all a result of the settlement, I'm sure. Because in a settlement, other than a financial reward, there's often changes made to policy.
Yes.
Johnny's family set up a scholarship fund in his memory called the Johnny Fiocco Jr. Scholarship Fund. And it's granted to students who share some of Johnny's qualities. So to close, I just want to talk a little here about why cases go cold, especially since in our current culture, most crimes are solved pretty quickly thanks to the advanced forensics available to us, along with national databases, surveillance, and the ability to track people's whereabouts through their phones or other electronic devices. And as we mentioned, at the time of Sigrid's murder, there was little forensic work that could be done. Because if you recall, DNA matching didn't come about until years after Sigrid was killed. And even though Johnny's death happened in 2006, forensics had only started really making headway a couple of years prior. And, you know, phones weren't really used yet for tracking purposes. And most people in the early 2000s didn't really carry their phones on them the way people do today. So it's likely that, you know, if this had happened today, Johnny would have had his phone on him at the time of the accident or the foul play.
Because we're talking 2006, that is what, seven? I'm so bad at math. That's 16
years ago. I think back to where I was in 2006. And right. I think back, I was in graduate school and I did have a cell phone, but there wasn't like social media, checking Instagram and Facebook. And you used it more when you needed it, not to kill time. And in fact, the iPhone came out in 2008. And I think that's when really people started being attached to their phones.
Well, because also in 2006, I had a flip phone.
I was just going to say I had like a Nokia, either a flip phone or,
You weren't, doing much other than making the calls you needed to make then. It was very different.
And surveillance was different as well. You know, Wolf Hall didn't have many cameras near the trash room, if any, at the time of Johnny's disappearance, whereas today they most definitely do.
Right, of course. Ugh. I mean, this case is solvable.
Yeah, I think it's possible that either of these cases can be solved. Evidence can be retested, though we should mention that every time you retest evidence, it breaks down, right? So law enforcement has to be choosy about the retesting process. But of course, it is possible to resend evidence for DNA testing. It's also possible to take the findings from DNA and send it to a forensic genealogist to reconstruct a family tree that can potentially lead to a suspect in either case.
Sure, which we know is a technique that's being used now by law enforcement.
Yes, very successfully, might I add.
Yes.
There is also a benefit to new detectives being put on cold cases who may see details about a case that someone else may have missed. So every time a cold case changes hands, there's a greater probability of new information being detected. And Megan, in some ways, even true crime can help get the word out. For Sigrid Stevenson, a TCNJ graduate named Scott Knapp took great interest in her story and has created a data collection that he shares with Ewing police about Sigrid's life in order to try to generate more leads. I'd like to say here that Scott also generously provided a lot of our backstory on Sigrid, and we're very grateful to him for sharing his wealth of knowledge to this episode. In fact, if any of our listeners knew Sigrid or have any information about her murder, you can reach out to Scott at savesigrid@gmail.com to have your information added to the database. Likewise, both cases are still open and active with Ewing Police, and they are still diligently hoping for a break. So if our listeners have any tips on either of these cases that you think could help investigators, you can reach out to the Ewing Detective Bureau at policedb@ewingnj.org. Before we go today, if you'd like to support Campus Killings, consider subscribing to the show with an Abjack Insider subscription through Apple Podcasts.
Your subscription will get you VIP access to all the shows on the network that not only includes hundreds of episodes of ad-free listening, but also bonus content and early access to episodes.
For only $4.99 a month or $49.99 a year, you'll unlock a variety of listener benefits, and you'll be supporting this show in the process.
Head over to Apple Podcasts and search for either Campus Killings or Abjack, and you can start your subscription with a free trial.
Your support is greatly appreciated.
Thank you, everyone, for listening today, and we hope you'll join us on the next episode of Campus Killings.
Campus Killings is hosted by Dr. Megan Sachs and Dr. Amy Schlossberg, with research and writing by Abigail Belcastro. It's produced by Mike Morford of Abjack Entertainment. Be sure to follow Campus Killings on social media. You can find Campus Killings on Twitter with the handle @CampusKillings or on Facebook at facebook.com/CampusKillings. You can also visit the show's homepage at campuskillings.com. Be sure to tune in every other Saturday for new episodes of Campus Killings.